can tell that you've been in education.
I have been in the public view.
Yes.
For too long. Not really.
All right. Well, let's get started then.
Okay.
Many listeners of the Dr. Lisa Radio Hour and podcast have themselves dealt with family members needing care at the end of their lives. And many listeners, I'm sure, have had family members with dementia. Our next guest is Leon Duff. He is a board member at large with Hospice Volunteers of the Waterville area. He's also past president of the Hospice Volunteers of the Waterville area, and many other things. But most importantly, he had a wife with Alzheimer's and cared for her for 10 years before her passing several years ago. I first read about Mr. Duff's story in the book A Healing Touch, True Stories of Life, Death, and Hospice, edited by Richard Russo, which is a fundraiser for the Hospice Volunteers of Waterville area. Thanks for coming in and telling us about your story and the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to share my experience, and hopefully I can encourage other people to become engaged in helping other people.
Well, and that's an important thing to talk about first, which is that you've been involved in helping people pretty much your entire life, but especially your adult life. You've had more than 45 years in education and 22 years spent as a superintendent in school systems.
That's true, and even in education, if you're not in it to make a difference, to help the students grow and to influence the parents in the involvement of the students, then I don't know why you're there. But the same kind of applies to taking care of someone who, in my case, my wife Anne, had Alzheimer's disease, and I'll tell that story a little bit.
All right. Well, let's start with first a little bit of your background. You are from a small town up near Holton in the county. You are the ninth of 10 children.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to hear you elaborate a little bit on that.
Okay. I was born and brought up on a potato farm in Derry, in Hodgdon. As you mentioned, 9 of 10 children, and there were 7 boys and 3 girls. And what's interesting about our family, I think, most is that 9 out of the 10 of us have post-high school degrees. And my parents had a 9th grade education. They were born in 1896 and 1897. I went to a one-room schoolhouse, which we all had to walk to. There were anywhere from 30 to 35 students, one teacher, and all grades from kindergarten through the 8th grade. And then I went to Ricker Classical Institute in Holton, which is a private school, and became acquainted with Anne in a geometry class. And this was our sophomore year, and she said to me, "Do you have any brothers and sisters?" And I said, "Well, yes, I have 6 brothers and 3 sisters." And she said, "How can you remember all their names?" I thought that was pretty funny. So we dated pretty much off and on for during our junior and senior years. And then Anne's father was a graduate of Colby College. And, of course, he wanted her to go to Colby. And her older brother was at Colby at the time. So she went off to Colby, and I went off to Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, because some of my siblings after the war went there for a college degree. After about a year and a half, she decided she wanted to become a nurse, and Colby didn't offer an RN degree. So she transferred to UConn, University of Connecticut, and in a five-year program, because that was required by UConn to get a bachelor's degree and an RN. So, after I graduated, majoring in education, which I switched in my junior year, and I said, you know, if I could get a job in the New Haven area, then we could get married. And so I applied to a couple of districts there, and I was offered a position in New Haven, Connecticut. And we went to the beach in East Haven after I had signed the contract, and we set a date to be married, which we did. And then Anne finished her degree work, and I was teaching at Bassett Junior High in New Haven, which was a 96% black school and 4% poor whites and whatever. That was a challenge. Growing up in Aroostook County, going to a private university, and then ending up in a junior high school, that was really challenging. And she finished up her work. She did some filling in at the hospital there, Yale New Haven. And then she became pregnant, and we had a child in the second year there. I started taking classes at UConn, and they were offering them off campus because they were in need of expanding. And so I took these classes primarily in North Haven. And so after 3 years in New Haven, I was recruited to a new junior high school that was just opening in North Haven. And so I went there. And so I was interested in becoming a school administrator. And so I applied for a position at Amity Regional, which was Bethany, Orange, and Woodbridge outside of New Haven. And I got the job. And so I then became an assistant principal and then principal of the school and eventually assistant superintendent in the district and then eventually moved to Woodbury and Bethlehem as superintendent of schools.
Woodbury and Bethlehem.
Connecticut. Yeah, out just west of Waterbury.
So how did you find your way up here?
Well, the board split in that district. It was interesting. It was four men and four women, and they split men against women. And I said, I cannot be effective if a board is split. So I looked at an opening in one in Massachusetts, one in New Hampshire, and two in Maine. I did not look at any in Connecticut. And I was offered the position in what was School Union 52, China Vassalboro Winslow. And I moved up there in 1984. And I spent 17 years as superintendent in the School Union.
And in the meantime, you had more children, it sounds like.
All of our children were born in Connecticut, all at Yale New Haven Hospital. And I also had a brother who was a pediatrician and a professor at the Yale Med School. And he lived there, and so it was not remote for us. It was kind of fun.
Now, did Anne continue to be a nurse when you came up to me?
Well, she was busy taking care of four children, two boys, two girls. And so she took some part-time work here and there. It wasn't fun being a nurse because if you're filling in, you don't know your patients, and she was put in charge often of a whole ward, and that was really challenging. So she found other things that she liked to do. She was a secretary in the North Haven town office, for example, and as a nurse, when the first flu shots started coming out, she did the flu shots for the town.
How old was Anne when you first started to notice that things weren't quite as sharp when it came to her memory?
She was about 57, and we had already experienced her father, who had dementia. They were calling it back then hardening of the arteries, as I recall. But it was clearly Alzheimer's. And his siblings all died with dementia, and her grandfather on her father's side. So it's clear that it's in the genes. And so she was, we were having difficulty, and then I had her go in for testing, and she was about 57, and the diagnosis was pretty clear, and so I knew what I was into, and she knew what she was into, because we had experienced that with her father. And it was challenging for her, and her mind went first. Couldn't remember an example. She drove to Waterville, which is only 6 miles away, and when I got home in the evening, she looked at me and she said, "I had a terrible experience today." And I said, "What's that?" She said, "I was in Waterville, and I had finished what I needed to do there, and I couldn't remember how to get home." And soon after that, we were up north, and we were driving two vehicles back home from Bangor to Vassalboro. And I said, "Well, you just follow me." And so we got down to about Albion, and she's falling behind. It's early evening, and she's falling behind and falling behind. And so I signal, pull over. She pulls up behind me, and I said, "You got a problem? You need to be closer to me so that I can see you in my rearview mirror." She said, "Well, I kind of had a blackout. And so I slowed down. I'm not really sure. I know I'm supposed to be following you, but I had a little blackout, so I started slowing down." Well, that was pretty much the end of her driving. But her mind went first. Physically, she was still reasonably normal. And she used to do the keep the checkbook and all that sort of stuff. And she approached me and then said, "I can't remember how to write the checks." And so, you know, little by little, it was getting worse. I was working full-time as a superintendent, and, you know, that's a, at least 60-hour-a-week job. And so I had some friends who volunteered to come and visit her during the day. Then I got involved with an agency, Helping Hands, in the area. And I started with part-time help, someone coming like 10 o'clock in the morning until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, help her get lunch and whatever, and then she'd be okay until I got home. That lasted a little while. She didn't relate to some of the people from Helping Hands. And finally, there was a young gal. She was probably 20, graduated from high school, had taken the course at Helping Hands, and then married. And she came, and Anne just blossomed right up to her. And so she was with me part-time for quite a long time. And she got pregnant, had a baby, and that was a miracle for Anne, because she would bring the baby in, and when she would walk in the house, it was just a whole different world. And she would put the baby in her arms, sitting down, of course, and it was like she had gone to heaven. It was just wonderful.
Now, Mr. Duff, they call Alzheimer's the long goodbye. So this process started when Anne was 57.
About, yeah.
And you took care of her for 10 years. What was that like to know that she had had a father and other relatives that had died of Alzheimer's, that this disease was going to be what it was, and that it wasn't going to get any better, and that you were going to lose this woman you had known since your high school years?
Well, I realized I'd already lost her because she couldn't communicate with me. She couldn't call me by name. And she would be puzzled if one of our kids came to visit about who is this. And so I lost her early and I knew it. And we had experienced that with her father as well. And to what degree she really understood that, I can't tell you, because they couldn't communicate that. But I kept her at home as long as I could. I got hospital, you know, bed sheets and things like that because there were accidents and whatever. And finally, I said, I cannot do this anymore. And one of my daughters and I explored some nursing homes. And Anne's mother, who was about 91 at the time, still living independently at home in Holton, begged me to put her in the nursing home up there. She said, then I can go and visit. Well, that's 3 hours away for me, and I want to say two things about that. That was an absolute excellent decision that I made to put her up there for her mother and for me, because I was worn out. I dropped 30 pounds taking care of her at home. And, you know, the emotional impact is I didn't care if I ate or not. Those are, you know, routine kinds of things. It wasn't that I was in denial. It's that it's too big a weight. And so giving care to someone who has dementia is very different than taking care of someone who just has, let's say, Hodgkin's disease or something, because I've had experience with that as well.
Can I read something from this book?
Sure.
This book is A Healing Touch, True Stories of Life, Death, and Hospice. And this is a fundraiser that Richard Russo, Pulitzer Prize author and friend of yours, wrote to benefit the hospice volunteers of the Waterville area. This is a story that he tells about you. When he was 10, one of his many jobs was driving the tractor. And one particular autumn found him harrowing a field long after dark. It was bitter cold, frightening work for a kid all alone on a tractor, traveling over unlevel terrain. The tractor's headlamp shone off into black woods that surround the sloping field on three sides, occasionally locating bright eyes among the trees. A cat's eyes, a dog's, a deer's, a bear's? No, probably not a bear's, but maybe. If it was a bear, could he outrun it? No. Even trying would risk death or dismemberment. You don't jump down from a tractor in the dark, not when it's trailing a harrow. Lee doesn't remember how much of the field he'd worked when the pin that attached the harrow to the tractor either broke or popped free, but he heard it go and felt the harrow detach. He also knew that it was pointless to search in the pitch darkness for a pin that was probably broken anyway. He knew his father would not be pleased, but what choice did he have? There was nothing to do but drive the tractor home. He remembers thinking, I can't reverse what's happened. I can't control it. It's gone. When he got home, his father was more than displeased. You don't come home with a job undone, he explained. Life demanded that you be resourceful. Problems had solutions. He should have found a way. He'd not only failed, he'd done the one unforgivable thing. He hadn't tried. This is a very interesting thing to be a 10-year-old and being told that there's always got to be a solution. And then to be, several decades later, a man whose wife is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and not be able to find a solution.
There isn't a solution. There is a process that you have to go through and hope for the best ending. My father was one who said, fix it up, wear it out, make it do or do without, which means that instilled in me was look at the situation and find a way to address it, to resolve it if you can. I think my upbringing was extremely valuable in times of crisis, because it is a crisis. Even in my work as a superintendent, there were times when there was crisis, and how do you go about dealing with it? And one of the things that I think I do is listen and ask questions and ask for help. And that usually gets a much better resolution to the issue. And it reminds me that a person with dementia often mixes up days and hours and whatever. You know, well, today's Sunday. We've got to go someplace. Well, it's Wednesday. It doesn't make any difference to the dementia person, and I have seen the caregivers try to correct that. Well, I learned that it's okay to lie, because it doesn't make any difference. In fact, it only aggravates, because they're being corrected and corrected and corrected. And I've used that in my hospice work very, very effectively. And I think that that is helpful.
Well, let's talk about your hospice work and about volunteering, because I know that this is something that has been very important to you. Just for example, we know that 37,000 Mainers are struggling with Alzheimer's disease, and that's just one group that needs care. There are lots of other people that need help, including the caregivers of the people who need help. You've been not only the president of the Hospice Volunteers of the Waterville area, you also have served on community impact teams for the Greater Waterville Area United Way, and also the Kennebec Behavioral Health Foundation Board and the Finance Committee. So you're somebody who really believes in volunteering. Why is volunteering so important, and what type of difference can people make?
Well, I kind of adopted the motto that as long as I am able, I want to make a difference. And And so if I have some experience, background, talent, or whatever that I can give, then I want to do that. I was invited to join hospice probably a year after Anne died, just before she turned 66 years old. And by the way, her mother died about a year before Anne died, and we did not tell her because it didn't make any difference, and we didn't want to add anything to her stress. And by the way, an important thing as a volunteer is you need to be very cautious about what you talk about in the presence of someone who has dementia, because they can't respond, but I don't know whether that they process it in any way or not. So you don't do that. All of the chit-chat is fun, friendly, and caring. The executive director of hospice at the time, who knew Anne, invited me. And what attracted me really to hospice was the support groups that they run for people who have lost a loved one, primarily, or someone who was going through a process at the present time. Those are dynamite and effective. And I took the training and to be sure I understood and all of that. It is absolutely essential to, in my opinion, to make a difference in whatever way it is, whether it's fixing a garage door for an old lady, which I did yesterday, or it's staying overnight, as I did a few weeks ago, for a man who has severe Hodgkin's disease. And I just continue to do that. And United Way is also a group. I serve on one of the three community impact teams, which recommends the support, financial support for agencies and whatever around the area. And United Way, for example, does a great job of making connections between groups to avoid duplication and things like that. And then Kennebec Behavioral Health, of course, serves clients who are in desperate need, usually. And so serving on the boards is just making kind of policy decisions, but I see that as well. I have a quote that I want to give to you. And it's my definition of a volunteer, and I didn't originate this, I don't know where I got it, but it's stuck in my head and I use it a lot. A volunteer is a person who will do for nothing what most people won't do for anything. And the other thing is that the more I give, the more I get back. I'll tell you a story. This lady I was talking to, she wanted me to do something for her. And this was probably 4 years ago. And she said to me, Lee, I'm want to pay you for this. And I looked at her and I said, well, if you're going to pay me for it, I'm not going to do it. And besides, you can't afford me. And that ended it. And I think that's clever. It brings lightness to, you know, a situation.
Well, Mr. Duff, we know that your time is very valuable, and we're very glad that you've spent time talking with us today. We encourage people who are listening to go online, learn more about the Hospice Volunteers of the Waterville area, learn more about the Greater Waterville Area United Way, or also, or perhaps the Kennebec Behavioral Health Foundation. Also, I was very moved by the book edited by Richard Russo, A Healing Touch, True Stories of Life, Death, and Hospice, which is a fundraiser for Hospice Volunteers of the Waterville area. So I encourage our listeners to find a copy of this book, read your story and other stories like it. And thank you so much for all the work that you're doing and all the volunteer work that you've made the world a brighter place by being a part of.
Well, if I can reach that goal, I will be very pleased. And thank you so much for having me.